Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Never Trumpers, the political movement of Republicans who speak out against the former president, are everywhere. On cable TV and online. Everywhere but the voting booth. Donald Trump easily conquered the primary election cycle, and no one has worked harder to understand the voters of today's Republican Party than Sarah Longwell. Sarah has been Never Trump since 2016 and is the host of the Focus Group podcast. She's brought along some of the best examples of Republican voters who may or may not end up following her down the Never Trump road in November. Sarah Longwell, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So we didn't give your full title because you're also the publisher of The Bulwark. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, this is, there was a conservative magazine called The Weekly Standard. And when it was unceremoniously killed because it was insufficiently pro-Trump back in 2019, we reconstituted it as The Bulwark with some new writers. But it's essentially a center-right publication that stands in opposition to Trump. And it's been around now for about 5 years. And it's great. You should check it out.
And it's growing. I mean, there's podcasts, there's a publication, there's more writing. I feel like Bulwark people are kind of everywhere.
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons The Bulwark has been so successful isn't just because it's been against Trump, but because the talent level is extremely high. You should go check it out and read Jonathan Last, who's the editor. Bill Kristol's got a morning newsletter that he does with Andrew Egger. We got a lot of podcasts. We've got The Next Level, Tim Miller's also got the flagship podcast that is daily. People have really responded to it. We've got this amazing community. You know, we do live shows, hundreds of people come and they're excited. It's been a really interesting turn of events, but nothing that I've done, and I've done a lot of different work. I'm not sure I'm prouder of anything than The Bulwark, because I think that it has given people a home, both an intellectual home, but also a community for people both on the center right who feel like they don't have anywhere to go, but also for center left folks who want to know what conservatives are thinking, but can't trust people who sort of bend the knee to Trump. And so I think it's built a really unusual community, but one that's deeply respectful, interesting, intellectual, and people should check it out.
So before we get into what you're up to now, I want to talk just about your history with the Republican Party, because you talked to me about being from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, often Pennsylvania is actually sort of the span of the state between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Now, Harrisburg, the capital, is right in between there. And I grew up in a sort of a rural town. There's about an hour away from Harrisburg. And there's not a lot sort of around that outer area. And I think it was James Carville who actually originated the—
Oh, that does sound like a Carvillism now that I think about it.
That's right. And I grew up in a town of 800 people that was all white. And when I sometimes look at maps now of around where I grew up, like, it is firmly Trump country out there.
When you got older and you become like part of political consultant circles, et cetera, what was your orientation, right? Are you a person who came up in the Bush era? Are you a person that came up obsessed with Reagan? Kind of where were you on that spectrum?
I was always a bit of a moderate Republican squish. It's funny when you said orientation, I was going to say lesbian.
Well, you were also, what, the head of the Log Cabin Republicans?
I was the first female board chair of the Log Cabin Republicans, and I did a lot of work with the Log Cabin Republicans, actually stemming from the fact. So a big part of my origin story is that I grew up in this small town in central Pennsylvania. I went to college in Ohio, Kenyon College, and I was a political science major there. And then I went to work at a conservative think tank in Delaware. It's actually not that far from Joe Biden's house. It was called the Intercollegiate Studies Institute.
And around when was this?
This is 2002, okay. 2003. They had a publishing imprint, and they were publishing Rick Santorum's book, It Takes a Family. And he was thought of as a presidential contender at the time, but he was also becoming famous for equating bestiality and homosexuality.
Yes, I remember this.
And because I was sort of the young comms person, it was my job to go on the road and travel with Rick Santorum.
And were you out then? Is that impolite to ask?
No, it's not impolite to ask. I was not, and I was super scared about coming out. I wasn't out to my family, maybe only a few friends, but I got so scared all the time. And during this time, actually, his communications director at his office, like his actual political office, was outed because this was a time when people were outing gay Republicans as sort of a way of
showing
it's
hypocrisy.
Like a political thing. Yeah, exactly. And I was so scared. And I remember I was at an event with Santorum and I was standing with some of the two lesbians and they had their like tween daughter with them. And she was holding a sign that said, "My two moms take me bowling." And I was like, "I'm done. I'm out of here."
Was it just seeing a kid having that courage or?
I didn't want to be on the side I was on. Like I was there as a representative for Rick Santorum and I didn't want to be on his side. I wanted to be on that kid's side. And so I left and moved to DC. And as a form of like penance for myself, I joined Log Cabin Republicans. And what's funny about that is there were no women and all, it was like just a bunch of 70-year-old gay men and me, but it was great.
There's something about your story where you're talking about that moment where you walk away from, you know, working with Santorum that is visceral, that has obviously stayed with you, and that is kind of helpful in thinking about how you could again reach a point where you say, "I can't do this," even as other people are saying they can when it comes to Trump.
I think that's a great point. I do think that there was a couple things I was comfortable with that made it easier for me when Trump came along to not do it. One of them was I was never completely tribally Republican, right? Like
a very good word. Thank you for saying that.
I was already on the outside. And look, I was just used to walking my own path where Democrats don't like you because you're a Republican. Republicans don't like you because you're gay. And you're sort of like, I'm going to stand in my own space. I'm going to explain why I feel the way that I do. And so I was comfortable with that. That was one thing. But the other thing is that I have my limits. I don't know. Like I had this, it was one thing to be like, okay, let me tell you why I could support Mitt Romney, or let me tell you why I could support John McCain, despite the fact that I didn't care for their positions on gay marriage. And like, that was a thing I felt like sort of reasonable people could talk about. People would get mad, but like we talk about it. Donald Trump, to me, didn't feel like everything reasonable people could disagree on. Like we could all look at it and be like, no, this is unacceptable. And watching so many people, it's like a zombie apocalypse, or like people, when everybody turns from being normal to the undead, where you just watched people who were on your side. Because in the beginning of the Never Trump situation,
well, finish that thought, people who are on your side.
People were on your side slowly begin to accommodate. Like Lindsey Graham is a great example, but all of DC was never Trump when I started. Right. We call it never Trump from the jump, but there was never a point in which
me the lingo now. But to jump in here, one of the things you've written about is how the move came to be, quote, "there needs to be adults in the room." So it was like this whole political class in Washington, et cetera, saying, you know what? We may not be for this. The voters have put us here. Let's make sure we're in there and guide this guy towards policy, et cetera. And I think we could put so many people in that category, public and private, right? I think about like how Speaker Paul Ryan, for instance, as someone who's like, I have to work with this person. We're going to make it work, be the adult in the room. And then fast forward 4 years later, most of those people have either gone Trump, been fired, kind of culturally excommunicated, just quit. And then there's a bunch who are silent. Am I getting the categories right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I do want to sort of defend the position of the Paul Ryans or the Jim Mattises. There did need to be adults in the room. The problem is a lot of people use that as a way to justify going in, and then they became sort of the boiling frog in the pot, right? Like they made accommodation after accommodation, they made excuse after excuse, and before you know it, they're so desensitized that they forget where the boundaries are, they forget where the standards are. Now that's not true of everybody. Like Paul Ryan ends up just leaving, but the problem is that what Paul Ryan has never only very recently been willing to do is to go out and say, this is wrong. We all know it's wrong. And this is what is maddening about Republicans, they all say, if you're in the world, they all say he's terrible. Paul Ryan, all the Republican members of Congress, not absolutely everybody, not the true believers like Matt Gaetz.
But there was an SNL skit about this, which is the kind of, to me, always the marker of, is everyone going to laugh at this joke because they believe there's a kernel of truth there?
The man doesn't care about this country one iota. Sometimes I think he's downright dangerous.
And you just endorsed him, right?
Yeah, big time, big time. I mean, he's great.
So great.
Yeah, he is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the category that I feel like maybe you didn't hit, which is a large category of people who all know it's wrong. And for political expediency's sake, and not for some honorable reason.
For their business interest.
That's right. And even if it started out that way or they told themselves that, that is not what it is now. That is not what it is now. It is not like Lindsey Graham's being an adult in a room. Every single one of them, what they are doing is building, and they have built a slow permission structure for the people who are not full-on Trumpers and people who were kind of regular Republicans to make the journey into full-on MAGA voters by saying things like Democrats are worse. The idea that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are equivalent, like, none of these people believe this.
But you're saying the permission structure is what they're building, meaning
that's right.
They're creating a vocabulary that has a sort of documented reasoning for why it's okay to go from, this is not the guy for me, to just being completely on board.
That's right. And it's a move from, well, Democrats are worse, so we have to hold our nose and do this, to, no, this is an affirmative good. Take January 6th. You can watch this journey happen, right? They went from, January 6th was a false flag operation perpetrated by Antifa and Black Lives Matter to, well, actually, it wasn't that bad. Nobody, you know, only a couple people got hurt. You know, a lot of denialism about why the police officers died. And now we're at the place where, like, no, it's affirmatively good. They are political hostages. They've got their own anthem. And we are here to salute them and to help free them because they are persecuted. Like, that's the journey of January 6th, but it's also the journey of lots of other things.
As a political consultant, as someone who has this in your history, you're kind of acutely attuned to the use of language and what those persuadable arguments are and can be. Even you just using the phrase permission structure.
I am attuned to the language, but more than that, I'm attuned to the emotions that I think drive people. And so, you know, there's these five dominant human emotions: fear, love, greed, anger, and sympathy. But fear and anger, that's what moves people, right? That's what makes you make decisions when you're afraid of losing something. You're super angry about something. And Donald Trump understands this about people. And he goes right to what people are afraid of, right? We're talking about immigration, crime. I want to hit people's centers of what makes them nervous and dislike each other and distrust each other. And then I want to make them angry about their grievances. And that is how he motivates people. And so we've got a lot of voters that are scared and angry. And that is like what is affecting our politics right now.
I'm here with Sarah Longwell of The Bulwark. We're going to talk about her podcast, The Focus Group, and the voters that she's been talking with right after this.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Welcome back. My guest is Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark and host of the Focus Group podcast. So before the break, you were talking about the emotions that move people. There were five of them. Can you list them again?
Fear, love, anger, greed, and sympathy. But fear and anger, those are the ones that really move people.
As you've been doing the focus group, we should tell people it is quite literally focus groups. You've done, what, 50 in just the last year?
Yeah, I do them every week, at least one a week.
Oh, my God. Just as someone who talks to someone for a living, that's a lot. It is. I'm, like, exhausted. When I'm done talking with you, I'm going to go lie down. Like, so, and you're listening to people in a state of, what did you say, fear, anger, greed, sympathy, or love?
Yeah. But mostly fear and anger.
But when you went into this process, as I understand it, and kind of talking to you, you know, in other venues, is you are legitimately, you were trying to figure out, how did we, as a culture, society, party, get here, where this person is not just appealing, but someone you can commit your cultural, emotional, financial resources to. So you were quite literally trying to do the thing that, like, lots of pundits get on TV and speculate about, which is to say, why do people support Trump? For the people who are in the middle, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, why do they stay? Am I getting those questions right?
Yeah, I think so. And I'll just say the reason I started doing the focus groups back in 2017 is one of my early bright ideas as a Never Trumper with Bill Kristol was we were going to primary Trump with a normie. And so we were out there talking to governors and, you know, congressmen, because all these people behind the scenes were like, I hate him. We got to go after
him. And I think it was Evan McMullen of Utah, who's a former CIA officer and a former staffer, who did at one point try to run.
So he tried to run in 2016.
Exactly.
He tried to run in 2016.
But I'm saying there was a model for this, right?
There was. Yeah. That's exactly right. And so going into 2020, we were trying to, you know, someone like Larry Hogan or something, like, you got to primary this guy.
But, and what's that phone call like?
Well, it was an in-person meeting. And it was...
We're here to recruit you.
It was exactly... It's me being like... This is what I do with everybody. I get really wound up and I say, the country needs you. You know, this is intolerable what's happening. And it was a real pitch. For me, it was a pitch to save the Republican Party at the time.
And what kinds of responses did you get? You don't have to talk about Hogan specifically, although he has publicly said
he considered it
a suicide mission and is now running for Senate. So just to give people a sense of the kinds of responses. But off the record, what were the kinds of replies you would get?
I think a lot of people were like, you know, they were interested, but mainly they had questions back, which was, could I win or could I not embarrass myself? You know, I think there was a lot of people who were like, I don't want to do this and get crushed. And so can you make the case that there's enough of sort of these old guard Republicans or enough people who don't like Trump that it would, because the argument I was pitching was, this is how you win back, right? You have to wave the flag. You have to plant a flag for the people who don't want to support Trump, weaken him. He'll lose the general election, and then we can rekindle the Republican Party that we know and love. And there was sort of like, okay, well, like, prove that to me, that there are enough of these voters. And that's when I started doing focus groups. I went and did a bunch of focus groups and a bunch of polling to figure out what was the sort of quantity of these voters and how did they think about Trump. And that's when, honestly, like, the scales fell from my eyes. Because I was very idealistic and I was running around talking to people, trying to make my pitch for why it's the right thing to do. And I listened to the voters in those groups and I thought, I have spent too much time in think tanks and too much time in Washington, D.C. And I had no idea this is how Republican voters sounded. Mm. And nobody else in D.C. knows that this is how Republicans sound either. They loved Trump. They loved him fine. They didn't care. They hated Hillary Clinton. Even the ones who didn't like Trump disliked her more. But there was like a million, I will tell you one of the big first things I've realized, and it was like such so obvious, but how many of them had watched The Apprentice? I never watched The Apprentice. I didn't think anything about Donald Trump and The Apprentice, but they'd been deep on The Apprentice. They thought he was so funny. You could not tag him with racist the way, you know, we're just talking about things like, oh, he's racist. They saw him have black friends. They saw him have Omarosa. They saw him have black characters that he was close to. Like, they just didn't buy a bunch of the things that people were selling. The celebrity made such a difference with people, and the fact that they felt like they knew him and knew him in the context of a carefully curated businessman. Because most Americans don't know what businessmen do. They think they fire Gilbert Gottfried every week. I don't know. But that was such a part of his intoxicating thing that I think people in D.C. just totally missed about him.
All right. So your producer was kind enough to send over some clips from your focus groups. There were two that were really interesting, and I want to talk about them because they get at what Democrats or others might perceive as Trump's weaknesses. So number one, of course, his legal problems, facing 91 charges of one kind or another, civil, criminal, state, all of these court cases that he is dealing with. And here's how one person framed it from one of your groups.
A jury could very well find him guilty, and he may very well be guilty. But why are they going after him and not everybody else? If they're going to go after him, I want to see them go after the Clintons, and I want to see him go after Biden, and there's been others. The fact that they're just going after Trump, you know, I don't believe that, that this should be happening. If they have a picture of him dropping a piece of litter in this street, they're going to want to have him executed.
So we just heard him talk about the idea that, like, it doesn't matter what the guy does, they are going to go after him. I hear this all the time.
All the time. Yeah. And this is where the connection that people have to Trump in terms of his grievances, their grievance, the attacks on him or attacks on them, which is a thing that Trump now actually says because they're aware of this thread that goes back and forth between them and the voters. But that guy is saying, and that was part of a group. I mean, I just remember that group actually vividly because it was so shortly after the document stuff. But it was like the two-tier justice system. You know, why aren't they doing something about Hunter? Why aren't they doing something about the Clintons? The what about and why aren't they? And like, this is just something they do for Trump. It comes from this place where they think everyone's corrupt and Donald Trump is the only one being held accountable when it's like, the inverse. It's the inverse.
Yeah, but can I, when you're in these groups, for the people who are maybe not as vehement as that particular voter, how do they process it? Because it is a lot of cases. It does start to look like, you know, and to me, I understand intellectually that these are disparate cases in many different states and many different places. I can understand a voter who says, this seems ridiculous.
So a lot of it is white noise to them. They're like, okay, yeah, there's all these cases. I had to start a new podcast with George Conway in which he explains the legal news to me because there's so much of it. And I am a deeply invested political person.
And as a reporter, that's the truth, like trying to keep track of his legal calendar. And so at a certain, and also some cases are about how he handled documents, and some cases about how he mishandled people. You know, like they get a little... You said white noise, but it is confusing following it all. And you're saying that's taking a toll.
One of Trump's superpowers is that there's so much bad information that people can't latch on to one specific thing. And the court cases are exactly like that. They can't tell Georgia from docs from January 6th. And there's all these sub cases, too. And then there's E. Jean Carroll, the civil cases, the business. So all they know is like there's a world of stuff coming at Trump. And if you are inclined to believe that this is because they are afraid of Donald Trump being president again, that this is the deep state out to get him, that no one person could endure this much. I mean, I hear that all the time for voters where they're like, no one else could withstand this much. Look at how much he has to go through. And he didn't have to do this. He was a rich guy. He was famous. He didn't need to do this. He did it because he loves the country.
So this is Trump as martyr.
That's right. That's right. And I hear it all the time.
There's another person that you heard from who was responding to the idea that Trump's history with women in particular, obviously he's been accused of sexual assault. He has been found liable in defamation against E. Jean Carroll in New York. Here was her response to that idea.
Does he respect women? No. But can he run the country better than Biden if that's all we have to choose from? Biden or Trump? I'm not going to choose Biden. He's incompetent. So I have to choose somebody to run the country. And that choice would have to be Trump.
Okay, so we heard this woman saying, I get it. And I hear a version of this kind of thing from voters actually not infrequently. Sure, X is bad. But I don't need him for X. I need him to run the country.
Yeah. I hear the opposite question all the time. People are like, how can women vote for this guy?
Yes.
And Democrats, I think, really struggle with the idea of how a woman could ever vote for him. And I'm like, well, I listen to women all the time. And it's not that they don't know what he said about women. It's not that they don't know that he is gross about women. They just don't think that that needs to be part of their calculation.
It's not disqualifying.
That's right.
Does it have anything to do with their perceptions about political correctness in their own personal lives?
Yes. Yes, it does. And actually, I sort of can't stress this one enough, is how much people think that everybody's being too sensitive. Everyone spends too much time tiptoeing around everything. And they feel like part of their character, one of the things that they believe is true about them, especially these women, is that they're not so sensitive about the women's stuff. You know, they don't get up in arms about it. And so that is for them part of who they are and a way that they identify. And they're annoyed at, and maybe that's because they want to say other things about different groups of people that are not women. And they've gotten, you know, the annoying person in their office who's telling them they can't say that, right? That's where they identify with Donald Trump. People talk about this in the groups all the time, which is their own personal experience with liberals in their lives, their sister-in-law, their mother-in-law, whatever, who tells them their politics are bad for some reason, or who really shames them for Donald Trump, or shames them for some opinion that they have, and that that is a thing that makes them want to vote for Trump more.
One of the things I've had trouble with understanding when it comes to Never Trumpers or with lawmakers or policy people who have come out to speak out against Trump in the aftermath of serving with him, there doesn't seem to be an acknowledgement of what people in the party did to lose those voters.
So you mean there doesn't seem to be any reflection from them on, like, why did these guys want Trump? And why don't they want sort of the three-legged stool
the
of
ladder.
Reaganism that I was
the
offering
ladder,
them?
Right? Okay. Like, I can listen to Never Trumpers who are talk about, like, America's place in the world. And I think, yeah, but people don't want to go to war anymore. They don't like it. Like, don't talk. Like, why are you talking about this thing that your voters don't want anymore? Or small government. I don't think people want small government. They want the government to do what they want it to do. They're willing to spend money on the things they think is important, right? So that's why Trump could just spend however he wanted, create the deficit, and there wasn't a new Tea Party to rise up against it, because the problem was what it was being spent on and on whom, not the spending. Like, has there been anything about the focus groups that have taught you where you're misaligned?
Well, this is when I said that I knew that I was spending too much time in think tanks in Washington, D.C. This is sort of what I mean, is that I was very obsessed by policy questions, especially around the debt. I was running whole campaigns on defeating the debt. At the time, I remember it was like $12 trillion, which seems like nothing today. And it's funny, I really believed that, of course, Americans care about the debt. They don't care about the debt. They might say they do. It might be like a reason for – and I was not a Tea Party Republican, but – I certainly understood.
Fiscal hawks were a thing.
But I was,
right?
A fiscal, but I believed in being fiscally responsible and not borrowing too much. And so I was sympathetic. But so much of what the Tea Party movement became was just early stages of MAGA. It actually had nothing to do with spending. You're right. There was no accountability for Trump on the debt or deficit. No one was interested. They wanted him to run the economy hot and keep the sugar coming.
But it's just one of these things where, and I say this not judgmentally, but because, you know, I sit on all kinds of panels and things like that with people who are ex-Republican officials, et cetera. And I just think, like, your stances on global trade maybe drove people away. Like, the stances on the debt maybe drove people away. Like, how you did deal with the safety net maybe drove people away. There are aspects of the way the party was running, definitely through Bush, that have come home to roost. But what I often hear are the ways that the media and Democrats and the LGBT community, right, just like that people have sort of pushed this community of voters into a grievance and into the arms of Trump.
Mm. Well, I don't believe that. I do think, though, that there is a populist movement that Trump is speaking to, some of which does have to do with policy, and I still disagree with those policies. Like, I think protectionist trade is not good. But you are right that voters respond to the America First. I mean, there's a reason Joe Biden hasn't changed that much of Trump's tariff policy. Voters like the social safety net, right? Like, one of the things Donald Trump did was be more economically populist, more socially, economically, actually, and even a little bit socially moderate and liberal. I mean, I think that Trump himself is a terrible, horrible person, but he has triangulated policy in a way that did sort of transcend the parties and that did allow him to get new people. But I'll also just say, on like the American leadership in the world, which is also a thing that I believe in, the Republican Party has changed on that. You're right. Republican voters, they don't want us to help Ukraine, but Democrats do.
Why do you think you haven't been able to crack the code, so to speak?
So a couple reasons. The first one is the Republican Triangle of Doom. So the Republican Triangle of Doom is the toxic and symbiotic relationship between Republican voters, the right-wing infotainment media, and Republican elected officials. They create this ongoing permission structure for each other. You know, the right-wing infotainment media demands that the elected officials say that the election was stolen. The voters want to hear that the election was stolen, so they tune into those places. So the elected officials have to go on, say it. It pulls the whole party into this crazy place. And I got to say that the number – listening to the focus groups, the number one thing that will take a Republican voter who says that the election wasn't stolen, the number one thing that they have in common is that they engage in a mixed media diet, which means they don't just listen to Fox News and then go deeper than Fox News, like in the Blaze Media or Steve Bannon's War Room or all the right-wing podcasts. They watch Fox News, but they also watch CNN. They also watch their local news. Okay, when somebody has that media mix and they're getting multiple streams of information, that is like the defining characteristics of the 30% of Republicans who do not say that the election was stolen.
So what does that mean for the bulwark, for the Never Trumpers, for all the people in your constellation who so far have won the vote of late night television and being in a cable news green room?
Well, so I don't think that's true. You said this at the top, and I didn't agree with it then. So I'll agree that it's a narrowish slice, but I believe it's the margin makers. In 2020, down ballot, Republicans did extremely well. Donald Trump lost because Republicans didn't vote for him. In 2022, Trump endorsed a whole bunch of incredibly Trumpy candidates who denied the election results as well, basically got through their primaries because they denied the election results. Republican turnout was higher than Democratic turnout in 2022, but Democrats still won all the key races. Why? Because a margin of those Republicans decided to vote for the Democrat. These swing voters have been making the critical margin now for multiple cycles. And in 2024, there's this number I'm obsessed with. It's 30%. Okay. 30% of Republicans don't believe that the election was stolen. 30% of Republicans say they won't vote for Donald Trump if he's convicted of a crime. 28% roughly of self-ID'd Republicans in South Carolina and in New Hampshire, not the independents, just the self-ID'd Republicans, voted for Nikki Haley. In Michigan, it was 27%. There is this slice of people who don't want Trump in the Republican Party.
And you
they
see
are
them
not.
As consistently surfacing.
Yes.
That's what I hear, that they're consistently making their presence known, even in those moments that we in the media describe as a win for Donald Trump. Because
that's
there's that 30% that keeps just popping their head up and saying, nope.
There's enough of that slice to be very meaningful and to win elections. And they are especially in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona. You know, these are a lot of college-educated suburban voters, and they've been trending toward the Democrats, or at least voting for Democrats.
So what would be going forward for Never Trumpers? Because it seems like the national path of just going head-to-head with Trump, that's not the path for you guys. Is there building a new, what you call, permission structure? Is it doing what you're doing with the Bulwark, creating another pillar of information? Is it, like, what can you do to convince people who are like you that they should vote or that they should run?
One, because like I said, I'm not particularly tribal. I think that the way that Republicans say, like, Democrats are crazy. Actually, the Democrats, they nominated Joe Biden. They nominated the most sort of milquetoast, least progressive candidate. There's been a huge new crop of Democratic candidates who look at Warnock, Wes Moore, Alyssa
Maryland.
Slotkin, yeah. Abigail Spanberg, right? There's this whole crop. They're winning in purple places. Gretchen Whitmer, Josh Shapiro. They've got a good deep bench and they're normal. People like me can vote for them. I don't feel like I have to build a new party. I feel like I can help build a faction in the Democratic Party that creates a center and a broader pro-democracy coalition that we could all live with. Personally, I think that that is doable. I think there's other people in the Never Trump movement who have this like allergy to the idea of ever doing anything that involves Democrats and feel like we need a new party. The thing about that is, if there's going to be a new party, it'll be Trump's party and there'll be a little rump and there's nowhere to go. Like the third party fantasies, I'm sorry that we live in a two party system, but like the parties are not so strong that they can't be hijacked by outside actors like Donald Trump did, but they are also strong enough that like you can't really break up the duopoly.
Yeah, like there's deep enough roots.
That's right. That's right. And so you've got to sort of work within that system. And I think building a diverse coalition that is pro-democracy, that is part of the Democrat Party, there's lots of political leaders within the Democratic Party that I think sort of these erstwhile Republicans, these Nikki Haley voters can feel comfortable voting for.
For you, is that giving up on Republicans and giving up on being a Republican?
So here's the thing. I opt out of this tribal frame. I'm an American. Like, what do I want? I want the country to be in a good place. I want us to not hate each other. I want us to have good leaders who think about how America can be a beacon for freedom and hope in the world. I want us to be a great place. And I think getting obsessed with the label of like, yeah, we're talking probably because I was a Republican for a long time. But, like, that was just a set of policy beliefs that I had and like some cultural things too. But like none of it's more important to me than being an American. And I think if people could just sort of push up from the right-left frame and think about the bigger tribe that we're all a part of and think about why the preservation of liberal democracy, like what the things that make us great, why we should fight for those things, it gets easy then to say, well, I'm never going to vote for these guys because they threaten the most important thing to me. And these Democrats are not my enemies. They're just other Americans that I can be in coalition with and that I'll have other fights with about policy, but it's not the end of the world.
Sarah Longwell, thank you so much for talking with me about your work and where it's going. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's episode of The Assignment. The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Dan Bloom. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio. We got support from Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lenny Steinhardt, James Andrus, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namorow. Thanks, as always, to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish. Thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.